A century and a half ago, Abraham Lincoln took perhaps the boldest stand in his stormy presidency. 17 months into the Civil War, Lincoln announced in 1862 he would issue a proclamation emancipating the slaves in America. People of color, denied in half the nation all basic freedoms accorded to whites, would now be equal citizens everywhere. The cruelty of slavery was depicted 2 years earlier in a July 4th oration by the escaped slave Frederick Douglass.
In the solitude of my spirit, I see clouds of dust raised on the highways of the South. I see bleeding footsteps. I hear the doleful wail of fettered humanity on the way to the slave markets where the victims are to be sold like horses, sheep, and swine, knocked off to the highest bidder. There I see the tenderest ties ruthlessly broken to gratify the lust, caprice, and rapacity of the buyers and sellers of men. My soul sickens at the sight.
A heated argument over whether slavery is moral went unresolved by the founders of America. When they drafted their Constitution in 1787, slavery was sanctioned. It went so far as to mandate that the rights of a slaveholder to own human beings be respected even in free states, and that slaves who escaped from the South be returned to their owner. The system for handling runaways evolved over decades and was formalized in the Fugitive Slave Act passed by Congress in 1850. Should a legal dispute arise, it would go before a U.S. commissioner, a special judge, to be appointed by the federal circuit courts throughout the nation. Professor Paul Finkelman specializes in the legal history of slavery at Albany Law School.
In a hearing before the U.S. commissioner, the alleged slave is not allowed to testify on his own behalf and indeed is not allowed to be called as a witness. The alleged fugitive slave may have an attorney if one shows up, but he is certainly not promised an attorney or guaranteed an attorney.
Critics of this law complain that the alleged slave was denied basic due process afforded any other accused person in federal court proceedings. In a case of mistaken identity, how could you prove who you were without the right to testify on your own behalf? It was in this legal no-man's land that Anthony Burns, a 19-year-old black man, suddenly found himself ensnared in Boston in 1854. Within days, it would ignite the largest anti-slavery protest the nation had ever seen. Albert Von Frank in Pullman, Washington, is author of The Trials of Anthony Burns.
Burns was born in 1834 in Stafford County, Virginia, to a family whose father worked on a quarry from which the buildings in Washington, D.C. were regularly made. Burns was barely literate. He managed, while still a slave, to cajole some people into giving him some instruction. And he was also a very religious person. And became a kind of informal Baptist minister to other slaves so that he would perform marriages and officiate at funerals, for example. And I think that was very important when he gets to Boston and people are much more sympathetic to him on that basis.
Unlike many slaves, Anthony Burns was not based at a plantation, regarded as property under Virginia law. His labor was literally rented out by his owner, Charles Suttle. In 1854, Burns was loaned to a druggist in Richmond, Virginia, who discovered he didn't have enough work for the teenager and instructed him to go out and find day labor, for which, of course, the druggist would retain wages earned by Burns.
He went down to the docks in Richmond and quickly found a ship bound for Boston with a friendly northern sailor on board. So he stowed away in February and arrived in rather poor shape in Boston some 3 weeks later.
On arriving in an unfamiliar northern city, Anthony Burns managed quickly to connect with people who could help him establish a new way of living in Boston as a free man.
Escaping aboard ship from Richmond was not unusual, so you had a number of people here who were from Virginia, a very organized and supportive community.
Beverly Morgan Welch directs the Museum of African American History in Boston.
They help people with food, lodging, clothing, medical expenses when they arrive in the city. And they give reports of this to the community. They talk about and understand what it is to transition from a from kidnap, enslavement, self-emancipation, kind of this orienting yourself to a new life. And they understand it's going to be difficult. They understand that they have to have employment, a church, and an education that will help them to cope and to become productive members of the society.
But helping escaped slaves adjust to a newfound freedom was only part of their mission.
This community has a long history of its abolitionist activity. From the Massachusetts General Colored Association in 1826 to the formation of the New England Anti-Slavery Society at the African Meeting House in Boston. This is a group of people born free, self-emancipated, self-liberated, purchasing their own freedom. And they understand that being organized is extremely important.
A dozen years earlier, Boston anti-slavery activists rallied behind George Latimer, a slave who escaped from Virginia and was arrested as a fugitive. The groundswell of public reaction showed the strength of the budding abolitionist cause in Massachusetts.
By the time they finish their fight for this, 65,000 people in Massachusetts have signed a petition that rolled up is the size of a small barrel, they say. So they know that they are continually pushing the envelope, must be vigilant, organized, and they are politically very active.
Is the movement, in fact, gaining support and momentum?
It gains great support, certainly, after this Burns incident.